And Father, open our hearts, open our minds, open our voices, that what is said today in this room will be the words you want us to hear, the words we say, the words you want us to say. Open our hearts to your living word. Let it transform us and create us anew. We make this prayer in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Amen. Well, today is a significant day in Cycle B. Today is the first day we actually leave chapter 1 of Mark's Gospel. Up until last week, we were still in chapter 1. Now, we're cheating, okay? Because just like last week, the first Sunday of Lent every year is always the temptation of Jesus in the desert. The second Sunday of Lent is always the transfiguration of Jesus. So that's why we leave chapter 1. We have to cheat a little bit and jump to, what is it, chapter 9 of Mark's Gospel to hear the story of the transfiguration, which, if somebody would like to read, I don't care, the New American Bible and the Revised Standard Version are pretty much identical, so anyone, does anybody want to, there is Diane.
Hi.
Hey. Anybody want to read?
Carol, you have it on there.
I'll give it a try.
Bigger print on the page.
Hey. Making it bigger,
huh?
Read it.
Huh? Making it bigger now?
Making it bigger.
Will we start up in the upper
do
left?
Just do the first column. That's fine.
This one?
Yeah.
Okay. What is the RSV?
Revised Standard Version.
Okay. And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. And his garments became glistening, intensely white, and no fuller on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, and they were talking to Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, Master, it is well that we are here. Let us make 3 booths, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. For he did not know what to say, for they were exceedingly afraid. And a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud, This is my beloved Son, listen to him. And suddenly looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them but Jesus only. And as they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one what they had seen, until the Son of Man should have risen from the dead. So they kept that matter to themselves, questioning what the rising from the dead meant.
Okay, thank you. And I think this for today, take 2 sheets, they're already collated. So
okay.
Take 2 pages and then just like she's doing and then pass them on. So we could refer to a couple of things.
I'm usually late anyway, but does this class start at 9 or 9:30?
9:30.
Okay, I thought so. I keep seeing in the bulletin 9, so I was...
It says 9 in the bulletin? Oh.
I thought
it was the office who changed
bulletin
it.
Bulletin is an error. That's so unusual.
Maybe I'm not. Maybe they changed it.
First, this is a first, I think.
I don't know why people call me sarcastic. I really
no, it says 9:30.
It does?
It says 9:30.
I thought I had seen something better. Maybe it was another one.
It doesn't matter.
We were discussing changing it to 9:32.
I made it today a little bit earlier than my usual late, yeah.
No, we should say it starts at 9 for you.
Yeah, right.
That's right.
I can't have my 9.
You have a story about that, don't you, Bob?
That is true.
Shall you tell the story again?
There is a lady who was taking college classes now that her child was old enough to leave in daycare at the school. Yeah, but she was 15 minutes late every single morning for this professor's class. And
which began, what, 8 o'clock or something?
It began at 8 o'clock, and she showed up at 8:15 dependably. So one day he stops the class, and he just reams her out, how rude it is to show up late, you know, no respect for the professor, her fellow students. But she says, let me explain. My husband and I only have one car, and I drop him off at work, and then I drop my kid off at daycare. but they don't let me drop him off before 8 o'clock. So I drop him off at 8 o'clock and I race here, and it's 15 minutes to get here. So here I am at 8:15 every day. It's my best effort. Well, the professor apologizes and understands her problem and tells her, for you, this class starts at 8:15. And from that day forward, she showed up at 8:30.
Okay, so with that, we get back to the matter at hand. So that was the account of the transfiguration in Mark's version of Mark's gospel. The story of the transfiguration occurs in all three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the synoptic gospels. Mark's is, of course, the shortest of them all, but he provides us with some details that the others don't. In terms of study aids, you know, I bring this just to show you. There's several books like this. I like this one by Aland called Synopsis of the Four Gospels. And I like this one because this one is the Revised Standard Version. So I'll pass this around. I marked the Transfiguration. The Transfiguration is not in John. But what these kinds of books do is they lay it out. So here's the story of the Transfiguration. Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And you see these big gaps here, for example. This is where Luke is telling you something that neither Matthew or Mark is, and you see that throughout. So that's a nice way, if you like to, you know, make it easy to compare what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John have to say about a given matter. There's a book that does that. There's a more popular one, I think, the one by Throckmorton. This is Aland. There's one written by a guy named Throckmorton that seems to be the most popular, but that's the New Revised Standard Version. The New Revised Standard Version is not a good translation. The Revised Standard Version is a good translation. Anyway, if you were Peter, James, or John, one of the ones that Jesus was bringing to this mountain of the Transfiguration, the first thing it says that happened, if I recall, is that he brings them to a mountain. Right? Mountains and Jews have a great significance. Important things, I even put a little bit on your hand out there. Things happen on mountains, things called theophanies, right? Encounters with God. Noah, the ark landed where? On Mount Ararat. Okay. Abraham, from our first reading today, Mount Moriah. Right? Moses, Mount Sinai. Jerusalem, Mount Zion. Mountains and religious experiences go hand in hand when you read the Bible. So when you see Jesus going up to a mountain, if you were a Jew and Jesus were taking you up to on a mountain, right, you would brace yourself because you would say, uh-oh, something is going to happen, right? This is no, you just don't, it's almost like, you know, being summoned to the White House or something. You know, I don't know, why, you know, I mean, the mountains. So interestingly, you know, in Mark's gospel, in Matthew's gospel, Jesus is a new, he's a new, what have we said? He is the new, remember?
Well, one of the things was a new Adam.
A new Adam, yes. That was actually the most important thing. He was also a new
Moses,
right? Where did Moses go to receive the Ten Commandments? Up Mount Sinai, right? Where does Jesus go to give the new law, the Beatitudes? The Sermon on the Mount.
Catskills.
And they took in a comedy club while
the Jewish
they were
Alps,
there.
As they're known as.
I love the Catskills.
The Jewish Alps. So, you know, now, so in both in Matthew, who was talking to Jews, and Mark, who was talking to Jews, you have the Sermon on the Mount. Luke was talking to Gentiles. That group of mountains were not as anywhere near as significant for them. So the Beatitudes in Luke's gospel is given where? The Sermon on the Plain. They don't go up a mountain. Need to go up a mountain because mountains wouldn't have the same meaning for them that it would for a Jew. So mountains are always treated as holy places in the Bible. But there's a difference here. Instead of them going up to the mountain and having God, a revelation of God come down to them, Jesus himself this time is transfigured. Okay? That word for transfigured, I think I put it in your thing, metamorphote. Metamorphote, where we get the word metamorphosis from. Metamorphosis means what? Change, right? You don't really see this very often, but it's a point that is often brought up in a more of a theological reflection on this. They call this the transfiguration of Jesus. Jesus really wasn't transfigured here. It was the disciples who were transfigured, and that they were allowed to see Jesus as he really exists. This is the real Jesus in the Father's glory and so forth, light radiant, shining and so forth, except that the disciples didn't usually see him that way. Jesus allowed them to get a little glimpse of how he is. But anyway, sticking to what it says in the text, it says, his appearance changed before them, and his clothes became intensely white, such as no fuller on earth could bleach them. That's where a book like that, stopped with Linda, that's where a book like that is becomes useful. Because if you compare the other two Gospels, Matthew and Luke, they say that Jesus, what did they say? They say his face becomes luminous. Mark doesn't say his face becomes luminous. He focuses on his clothing becoming brilliantly dazzling white and so forth. And that's interesting too, because whenever you look in the Old Testament where heavenly beings show up for whatever reason, angels for example, they are almost always, I mean, I don't know if I want to say always without actually checking, but they are almost always clothed in brilliant white garments. So, in other words, the message is Jesus is now viewed as some sort of heavenly being, not just an earthly being anymore. It's like in the book of Revelation, chapter 12, the book of Revelation of the woman clothed with the sun. It's not that it's just a white dress or whatever that she's wearing, but she's clothed with the sun. The garment itself is luminous. The garment is giving off its own heavenly light. So Mark, peculiar or uniquely, is there, I guess the right word, Mark will focus on white clothing in order to show that although Jesus is fully human, he is also a divine being, or he is in actuality a heavenly being, a divine being. And again, what Jesus is giving the three apostles here, Peter, James, and John, is a glimpse of the glory that's hidden beneath his human appearance that most people see, that appearance of flesh. So from a Jewish perspective, this transfiguration is what they would call a theophany, right? A revelation of God and so forth. And again, as opposed to God coming down from heaven in spirit, now Jesus is revealing something new, right? He's revealing his humanity and also revealing his divine identity, his divine glory and his divine power, which he's been. And then it says that Moses and Elijah appear and that they're talking to Jesus on the mountain. In the Old Testament, this is on your handout, I believe. Did someone only take one sheet? No, wait a minute. There's one. Is somebody missing a second page? Everybody has two sheets? Yes?
I have one and three.
Well, they're two-sided.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
So you also have two and four.
I was going to say, then four must be on the other side. Very good.
Interesting how that works.
I learned something already.
You see where it says there, Moses and Elijah appear talking to Jesus. In the Old Testament, Elijah and Moses both experience theophanies, appearances of God on the top of a mountain, in this case, Mount Sinai. And I put a couple of things there. I don't know if Exodus, the book of Exodus, chapter 33, then Moses said to God, he's on top of Mount Sinai, Moses said to God, "Please let me see your glory." The Lord answered, "I will make all my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim my name, Lord, before you. I who show favor to whom I will, I who grant mercy to whom I will. But you cannot see my face, for no one can see me and live. Here," continued the Lord, "is a place near me where you shall station yourself on the rock. When my glory passes, I will set you in the cleft of the rock, and you will cover you with my hand until I have passed. Then I will remove my hand so that you may see my back, but my face may not be seen." So it was understood that no one could see the face of God and live. So even Moses on top of Mount Sinai didn't actually see God. God kind of told him to go in a little crevice behind the rock.
I thought he was in the bush, the burning bush.
That was Abraham. Oh, this is on top of Mount Sinai. That was the call of Moses you're thinking of way in the beginning.
I was thinking when he got the tablets.
That was on Mount Sinai.
Yeah, so I thought that's when the burning bush happened.
No, that was when it was called the call of Moses, earlier in Exodus. Okay. Yeah. So you couldn't actually look at God. Then Exodus 34, I think I have the Lord. If you continue on, that the Lord said to Moses, "Cut," and I took out a lot. I don't even want to read all this. Then the Lord came down. The Lord said to Moses, "Cut two stone tablets like the former, that I may write on them words which on the former tablets that you broke." Remember, he came down. He found them worshiping the golden calf. He got so mad he smashed the tablets and all that. And he had to go back and tell God, "I broke them. You gotta give me two more."
how fast could he cut stone?
I don't know.
He was God. He could do anything.
No, it says Moses cut the stone with his jackhammer.
Oh, where are we now? Here. "Get ready tomorrow morning when you are to go up Mount Sinai. There, present yourself to me on top of the mountain. The Lord came down in a cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. And he said, 'You shall keep the Feast of Weeks.'" When I copy scripture, by the way, I just copy it from the bishop's website. I don't type out all these Bible passages. I go to USCCB.com, the United States, and they have a link there to Books of the Bible. And I simply go and copy it from, and that gives us the same version that we have in a lectionary. So that all works well if I take it from the bishop's website. But I figured I put it's on the back on page 2 there, the Feast of Weeks. Diane, you remember that from Brooklyn, you said the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Weeks. You know,
are you talking about Shavuot?
Yeah. The Festival of Thanksgiving for the Harvest, celebrated 7 weeks or 50 days.
No, Sukkot.
After the beginning, it was also called Pentecost, 50th, and coincided with the giving of the law, 50 days. People would offering the first fruits, and they would live in booths. Yeah, this is referring to that Jewish feast, right?
Sukkot,
yeah. So anyway, you could read there. And the thing I put that in for is I want you to note that cut two stone tablets for the Lord. The Lord came down in a cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. Okay, so God appeared in a cloud. Remember that. That's how God appeared to Moses. And so in Exodus chapter 34 there, God goes up the mountain. He says, "I want to see your glory." God tells him, "You can't see my face. No one can see my face and live. But I'll put you in a cleft in a rock, and I'll pass by, and you'll be able to see my backside. And so Moses is able to see God's glory, but not its fullness. He wasn't able to see his face. Notice it's different here with the Transfiguration. They see Jesus in full glory. A similar thing happens in, you have from Kings there, right? Elijah. Where did it go? I put Kings on here too somewhere. Didn't I?
Yes, on page 2. This kind of similar thing happened to me.
Oh, why can't I see? Page 2. Where is it? Show me.
Is this it?
There it is. A similar thing happened. This is a similar thing happens in 1 Kings chapter 19. This is where we read last week. He got up, ate, drank, and strengthened by that food, he walked 40 days and 40 nights to the mountain of the Lord. Okay, so we left off with that from last week. Now I'm putting in, then he came to a cave where he took shelter. But the word of the Lord came to him, "Where are you, Elijah?" He answered, "I have been the most zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. But the Israelites have forsaken your covenant. They have destroyed your altars and murdered your prophets by the sword. I alone remain, and they seek to take my life." Then the Lord said, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord. The Lord will pass by." This is, everybody loves this, right? There was a strong and violent wind rending the mountains and crushing the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. After the fire, a light, silent sound. When he heard this, and here's the part, Elijah hid his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Okay, so again, Elijah, you know, God said, "I'm going to appear to you, and you know, you're going to see my glory," but not directly. Elijah had to stand again in the cleft of the rock. This again is happening on Mount Sinai, the same Mount Sinai. But Elijah has to hide his face with his cloak as God passes by, because again, you can't see the face of God and live. Okay? So Moses and Elijah are two figures in the Old Testament who had experiences of God, but they couldn't see God directly. Now in the Transfiguration, they appear, and they are able to talk with Christ, who has all the glory of God, but now who has also become man. So now, through in the person of Jesus, as Jesus says later on in John's Gospel, "Whoever has seen me has seen the Father." So in the Old Testament, just like Moses and Elijah, they've always wanted to see God's face, and God answered that desire. They always said, "Lord, let," Moses said that, Elijah said that, "Lord, let me see your face." And what was God's answer? "No, I'm sorry, you can't. If you see me, if you see my face, you die." But now God answers the prayer in the person of Jesus. Now they could look upon and see the face of God in the incarnation. Now God has a human face. So with all this going on, Peter and James and John are awestruck. I mean, you would be too, most likely, if you saw something like this happen. This
so,
is not,
so Adam and Eve never saw God's face either, right?
Not that we know of, no. They they heard his voice.
And they the rustling and the...
That's right.
They never saw him. Okay.
They never actually... Not that... I'm trying to think if it says anything. No, it never says anything about Adam or Eve seeing God, right? They just heard him and they felt his presence and all that stuff. Just, you know, there's two stories of creation. One God is close, one God is far. So, you know, you contrast both of those. So Peter, James, and John, they're awestruck. They don't know how to respond. I mean, you know, da, 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 ha, 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 ha. Well, to Ralph Cramden, hum, nah, 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 nah. That's basically, you know, so. You remember that, right? That's basically Peter. He doesn't know what to say. He sounds kind of stupid in here, you know, but it's a stupid because he just, what's going on here? What do we say? So he says something that sounds actually rather silly. He says, "It is good that we are here." Talk about putting your foot in your mouth, you know. He witnesses the transfiguration and the Moses and Elijah. And what's his response? Basically, he says, "Well, this is nice." Kind of the understatement of the millennium, you know. And he says, "Master, it's good that we are here." Now, master is what they translated in the gospel here, the English translation. If you look at the original Greek, it says rabbi. Okay,
yeah,
so.
Said,
yeah, it says rabbi.
Are you on that one, master?
It's not on your sheet, I don't think. Okay. I don't think that's on your sheet. I just put snippets on your sheet here. So, you know, he uses the word teacher. Rabbi means teacher, right? Something like that. So, again, to call, after seeing this, to call Jesus rabbi is, again, kind of an understatement. It's just His divinity has been unveiled. He doesn't call him Lord or anything. He says, Rabbi, it's nice. This is nice.
Nice to be here.
It's nice that we're here. So he's not exactly giving Jesus the title that you would think adequate to this revelation of his divinity. So that odd statement that it's nice that we're here, you know, Master, it's good that we're here. Mark actually goes on a little bit and tells us, if you look on in the Gospel, why he made this statement. He said he didn't know what to say because they were exceedingly afraid. So, you could relate to this, I think, if you ever found yourself in one of those hamana situations. You don't know what to say. And when you say something, it usually comes out sounding awfully stupid, you know. And that's basically what Mark is saying here. Peter just didn't know what to say. So it's not that he's being foolish or silly. It's just that he was awestruck and afraid. And so Peter is having the standard response to a theophany in the Bible, a revelation of God, which is fear. Not fear like, oh my God, I'm dead kind of thing, but fear more in the sense of awe. You know, I mean, this is an awesome experience. And words just don't fit, you know, the glory, the power, the majesty of God that he has just experienced. And so he suggests making three booths, one for Jesus, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. It's interesting how biblical scholars, as you read these various commentaries and so forth, they're not entirely clear what Mark is saying, what Peter had in mind here, what did actually he mean, that maybe the obvious reason, that first thing that comes to mind, is that this experience, this joy of the transfiguration was so good, so nice that, you know, let's just stay here. You know, this is good. I like this. Why don't we stay? Others are suggesting, and that's why I put in as much as I did from that handout in your handout on Exodus and people living in the booths and so forth. Others explain that Peter, you know, was recommending that they made booths the same way the Jewish people would make booths during the Feast of Tabernacles. This, again, if you look back, I don't think I put Leviticus chapter 23 on your sheet, did I? In Leviticus chapter 23, we get something called the Feast of Booths, some translated as the Feast of Tabernacles. And during that feast, which would happen in the fall, it would be a harvest festival, people, Jews, would celebrate their deliverance from Egypt and their Exodus journey into the Promised Land and so forth. And living in tents, they would sort of reenact that as let's not forget what God did for us, even to the point of we go and live in tents. I found it interesting that you said in Brooklyn they would set up tents in the back or in the living room even.
Yeah, but even in Miami, at one point they had a thing set up at one of the condos. I went to it, and what you do is you bring your food there and you eat there.
Yeah. So it's again our
they built reed out of reeds behind the synagogues.
Yeah.
And at night there'd be lights in there, and that's what they celebrated that feast. Yeah. It was sukkah, right?
Sukkah, yeah.
I mean, it's kind of very liturgical in the Jewish faith.
Wherever you could do it, you do it.
You
have a house, or if you have an apartment, then you set up a little thing in your apartment. Wherever you have a place.
It's a reminder, you know, it's sort of the equivalent of us having the Easter fire or having holy pictures around the house or things like that. It's a physical reminder of what God did for us in that great central event of the Exodus and the deliverance from Egypt and the Promised Land and sort of this sort of thing. So some people are suggesting that that's what Peter is talking about. That Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkoth and so forth, is a feast of joy. It's a feast of thanksgiving, you know, because it's a harvest kind of feast. It happens in the fall. So some people are saying, well, that's what Peter is getting at. And it's sometimes linked with what the Jews call the life of the world to come. You know, there's this life and there's the life of the world to come. They don't actually say heaven very often. I mean, modern Jews say heaven. But, you know, traditionally, whatever comes after this life, and what comes after this life is the life of the resurrection, the life of the Messiah. That, you know, We're still waiting for the second coming. We believe the Messiah came, that's Jesus and so forth. Jews believe that this would all kind of happen at once. The Messiah would come, the Messianic age would be ushered in, that would be the end of the world. The world to come would be the, you know, what we look for is, you know, the resurrection of the dead, and we say it in the creed. We look forward to the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come. Amen.
There's something I never understood, if I could,
It's
not really with this, but my mother always said, well, Jews don't believe in hell, yet they would use the word Gehenna.
You
know, so I don't know what
you hear strange
I never
things.
Know what she meant by that.
You hear strange things. It's not that Jews don't believe in hell. They just don't use the word hell. They call it the land of the dead, you know. That's hell. It's a land that
I never understood
that. It's not even a linguistic thing, but it's just a, what's the word I'm looking for? How you describe something. It's like a lot of, you know, Orthodox Christians or, you know, Greek Orthodox don't believe in purgatory. Well, if you read their theology, yes, they do. They just don't call it purgatory. They call it a period of purification. Well, that's what purgatory is. And when we say, well, that's what it is, they say, oh, no, you talk about it like it's hellfire. Well, you know, we describe it like, you know, how do you describe purification? How do you take what we don't know what it's exactly going to be like, but we know it's a time of purification. How might you describe purification? Well, as some sort of intense purifying fire or whatever, you know, and so there's these disagree. It's the same thing with hell. You know, Jesus is the one who talked about the fires of Gehenna. Gehenna was a garbage dump, right, in the Holy Land, in Jerusalem. It was the place where pagan tribes, pagan religions would offer their human sacrifices, and the human sacrifices were known to take place in this place called Gehenna. So for Jews, that was such a horrible thing that nobody wanted to build there. Nobody wanted to live there. Nobody wanted to. So they used it for their garbage dump. And it was kind of downwind from the city, too, which is kind of practical. You don't want to put it there, right? You don't want the winds blowing the stench. So what do you do with garbage back then? You burn it, you know, and all that garbage going in there for a city was always burning. So Jesus used that image of, you know, all you'll be good for is to be thrown into the fires of Gehenna where the flames never go. You know, we associate that with hell. Jesus wasn't exactly, he didn't say, you're going to be thrown into hell. He said you'd be thrown into the fires of Gehenna where the flames never go out, however, you know. But it's the same thing, you see, just said in a kind of a different way, you know, and I think the same thing there. You said they don't say hell, they say Gehenna. Right?
No, they use the word Gehenna because that's whatever Hebrew thing, but I mean, it's
and that's the meaning of Gehenna, the place of unquenchable fire.
Okay.
When we use the word Gehenna, most Christians don't know about Gehenna, you know, you gotta, because I don't know what's in Gehenna today in modern Jerusalem, and probably apartments, you know, condos. I mean, most likely, right? Land is precious there. But it was a place where nobody wanted to go and where there was always garbage burning and so forth, and that's called the fires of Gehenna.
They wouldn't hesitate to tell someone to go to hell.
Is what?
They wouldn't hesitate to tell someone to go to hell.
Yeah. Hell may not exist.
Right.
They wouldn't hesitate to someone to go to hell. And how does a Southerner tell somebody to go to hell? They say, bless your heart. You know, whereas I've learned when a Southerner says, bless your heart, they're telling you go to hell. You know, I noticed that. I mean, when they're angry, when they say, well, bless your heart, you know.
I've had some nurses, though, tell me, well, bless your heart, and I didn't think they needed
to. Well, I guess it's the context. I guess it's the context.
Yeah. Church lady on Saturday Night Live.
Is that? She'd say, bless your heart.
Bless your little heart.
So that really means go to hell.
No.
Could we be speaking of Satan?
So, you know,
what's the land of the dead then? Is that?
Well, you know, I hate to say this, but in a certain sense, Jews are not as bold as we are to want to be able to define everything. You know, what is heaven? What is hell? What is purgatory? What is limbo? What is this? What is that? Once you're dead, you go to the land of the dead, you know, whatever that means, you know. The netherworld, the depths of the netherworld. So people say, well, since they don't articulate a theology of hell, they don't believe in hell. Well, you know, there was a time when, you know, you would ask most Christians, what is hell? Well, it's down there. Hell isn't down there anywhere. You know, the center of the earth is down there. That's not hell. You know, nor is heaven up in the sky somewhere. You know, I mean, those are states of...
the man upstairs.
The man upstairs. Those are states of existence, states of being. You know, after you die, where do you exist? Well, the unrighteous, the unrepentant sinner goes to this place called hell. The forgiven, repentant, whatever Christian goes to this place called heaven, but you don't go up into the sky. You know, it's not like, and this is, you know, it's interesting because this is actually a recent thing. This is how the Soviets, you know, the atheistic Soviet Union would criticize us, because they would, you know, when they were beating us, remember, in the space program early on. And they could remember, I was too young for them to remember them saying it, but I remember reading that when their astronauts came back, they wanted to stick it to us by saying, man has been to the heavens and God is not there. So that was their way of you know, saying, aha, you see? Because people, yeah, you know, if you think back, even what, 50 years? Let's say for sure 100 years. If you go outside on a beautiful sunshiny day and you look at a sunrise or the sunset and you see the rays coming down and so forth, you could almost, I mean, God is just, I can't see him, but he's, you know, he's just there. You know, I can look at the beautiful light coming through. You know, now that we have deep space explorers going up there and God's not there, you know, you could start to ask questions like, well, is he? You know, where is Mary that has been assumed bodily into heaven and Jesus who exists bodily in heaven? Where exactly are they? You know, can't answer those questions. Those are beyond our human ability to come up with concrete answers to say, okay, this is the place. This is the physical address if you want to send them a letter, right? But they're states of existence, states of being that transcend far beyond what our human understanding has seen or has known, right? Eye has not heard or man has not seen what God has. You know, eye has never seen, ear has not heard what God has in store. In other words, it's so far beyond you. You know, if you want to try to figure it out, I oddly enough, my personal best way of explaining this comes from Shakespeare. You know, there is more in heaven and earth, Horatio, than dreamt of in your philosophy. And that's what it comes down to, right? There's more going on than we think of ourselves as having all the answers. We know it all. We don't even begin to know, right?
Now, do modern-day Jews, is there still that division as there was, like the Sadducees and the Pharisees, those who believed in life after death and those who did not? There still is that?
No, all Jews believe in, I can't say.
I don't think, you see... Catholics have this very centralized, top-down kind of faith with everything delineated and explained in catechisms and books and doctrinal statements and so forth. I don't think there's another religion that has that, except maybe the Greek Orthodox Christians, you know. But anybody else, you know, I mean, Baptists, how many Baptist conventions are there? They believe different things, right? A Jewish, you know, most popularly there are the conservative, the Orthodox, and the Reformed, right? I mean, those are the three. There's did you know Menachem Lubavitch? You know him?
I know, but there's a Lubavitch movement.
That's right.
I know a girl in New York who used to be my neighbor. She's
Chabad,
Lubavitch.
Right? The Chabad centers for Lubavitch
right.
Jews. He was a rabbi that lived 1930, was born maybe 1910 or something like that. And there's a group of Jews that believe he was the Messiah.
No, I don't know that.
Yeah,
Menachem. They're very religious and they call themselves Lubavitch.
There's a Jewish on campus right behind, you know, Hillel on University. That's where the Chabad Jewish Center.
I don't know that they would think that he was the Messiah.
And then he died in 1990, and But there are still Jews who believe he's the Messiah. How that works, I don't know.
I'll have to ask Susan about that.
Now, I have a student who's... I have two students, as a matter of fact, who go to the Chabad.
Well, then you can ask them.
I have. We talked about it.
They believe that he was a...
I said to them, do you believe in God? And they, after a long hesitation, said, yeah, I think so. Like,
you think so?
Yeah, exactly.
It takes a lot of courage on a college campus.
Well, but, you know, it wasn't like, these are Jews. These are super Jews.
I know it's all Jews believed in God, but as far as the Messiah,
young.
I thought...
They're not, young, that's
Bob
right.
Bob said it takes a lot of courage.
They're young.
There's a God.
But they go to Chabad on Saturdays, Friday nights. They're there. They're practicing. But they're more national Jews than they are religious Jews, you see. Mm-hmm. So... To them, Israel is a nation, which right. also happens to be a religion, but we don't pay much attention to the religion part. You know, they're Catholics, right? That too. We're called cultural Catholics, right? I'm Italian. No, if I'm not Italian, but, or I'm Polish. You know, Polish are Catholics. Yeah, that's what we are. We're Catholics. You know, you go to church? No.
My Polish friend is Jewish.
Well, that's because the Poles welcomed the Jews when they were being persecuted. In all these other countries, the king
of Poland
said,
Poland and she
said "Come on in." But then things went bad there too for them. But that's history. But it's like just like we have cultural Catholics, so there are Jews who,
It's not a nationality, Judaism.
It is. It's a nation. It's the nation of Israel.
But see, this is what
Judaism
I always get.
Jewish is a
It's both.
Jewish
it's
is
both.
Religion.
I never looked at it that way.
No, I never do either. Jewish, to me, Jewish is a religion, because I was Jewish and I changed, so what am I?
But then what about the nation of Israel?
But I'm not Israeli, I wasn't born in Israel, so that's national.
But you're, as a Jew, you're welcome into the nation of Israel.
Well,
you could move there, you could... So there's a lot of people who understand Judaism. I mean, there's been a lot of interesting stuff written on this. You know, it's because it's a mindset that is so hard for us to get into, of being both a religion and a nationality.
I have a gap because a friend of mine goes to Baptist church. She goes, oh, so-and-so is a full-blooded Jew, and they were born in Israel, and they got the big nose, and she's telling me all this stuff.
You see, as Americans, that is so foreign to us. This idea of a religion, which is also a national identity that goes back 5,000 years to Abraham, right? I mean, this is and that one that they had to fight so hard to preserve that national identity. You know, still Orthodox Jews are forbidden to marry outside the faith, right? Yeah, because it's so precious that they want to preserve the heritage.
I married Catholics twice. My parents were really pissed.
So, you know, I guess we're getting off a little bit here, but how did we get onto this anyway?
Because I interrupted and asked you again.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, there's a Chabad for students on campus, and the ones that I know there are not entirely sure if they believe in God or not, but they go to Chabad every week and do what they do. Yeah. And they believe, they're kind of like our founding fathers. I think talking to them, they're more like deists. Yeah. Okay, there's God. He's there somewhere.
That's so foreign to me. One of the most religious groups that you're saying is Lubavitch doesn't believe in God. I don't get that.
Well, I don't know that Lubavitch would say that as a policy or something like that, but here are members of the community who can't. I was expecting a resounding, of course I believe in God. You know,
I didn't get that.
This is nice. You know, one of them is a woman. You know, I said, well, what is it about your life? She goes, well, they sponsor me, give me scholarships. I can go spend time in Israel, go look at Israeli defense companies. You know, get to see the country and so forth. Get familiar with it. It has nothing about her faith. It's just I like to go to Israel, and they'll let me go to Israel. Yeah. Anyway, we better get back on track here. So. In that Jewish tradition, that's where we were. That's how we got on this, right? That feast of Booth, Sukkot, is linked to the coming of the world to come, the age of the Messiah, which to Jews will come at the end of the world. See, so there's been a difference already between, big difference between the Jewish understanding of the Messiah and the Christian understanding of the Messiah. We believe the Messiah came, but the end of the world obviously hasn't come yet. We're still waiting for the second coming. So the Jews didn't have a notion of the second coming. The second coming was going to be the coming, okay? So some scholars are saying, no, Peter is thinking a lot more deeply than that. Peter is thinking, this is the beginning of the end here. This the end of the world has arrived. The world to come is being ushered in. We've kind of died and gone to heaven, and to make the connection with the Jewish understanding of Sukkoth and the coming of the heavenly kingdom and so forth, let's build these booths, you know, so, you know, we could stay here. He's making still a big error here in that he says, let's make three booths. One for you, he says to Jesus, let's make three booths, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. You notice that he's putting Jesus on the same level as Moses and Elijah. He doesn't say we're going to make the big one for you, Jesus, or anything like that. He said we're just going to make three of these things and put it for the three of you. Jesus is being revealed here as greater than Moses, greater than Elijah. And how do we know that? How do we know? Again, everything we have to ask, how do we know that? You know, how do we know that if Jesus isn't on par, equal Jesus, Moses, Elijah, the three old buds, three paisans standing up there talking about things? Why are Moses and Elijah beneath Jesus in glory? Mark tells us, and that's why we read that thing from Exodus as we did, as God coming down in the form of a cloud. That's how God comes down. You can't, but he on all these theophanies, on all these mountains with Moses, with Elijah, God, look at them both. Look at 2 Kings, look at Exodus. God comes down in a cloud. What happens here? A cloud comes down. A voice from the cloud. Just like on Mount Sinai before with Moses and Elijah, God appears. God the Father, so to speak, appears in the form of a cloud, or comes down on a cloud. And he says, not anything about Moses and Elijah, but he says, this is my beloved son. Listen to him. So God comes down in a cloud and he points to Jesus and he says, he's the one. Okay, so Peter does he messes up there, but then God straightens it out when he comes down in the when he comes down in the cloud. And I think on your sheet, you know, I see it right here on page 2, Exodus 40, right? Remember when the Jews were traveling in the desert? And well, here, let's read it, and then you'll see what I mean. In Exodus 40, on the bottom of page 2, toward the bottom of page 2. Then the Lord said to Moses, on the first day of the month you shall set up the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. Put the ark of the covenant in it. Screen off the ark with the veil. Bring in the table and set it. Bring in the menorah. Set up the lamps on it. Put the golden altar of incense in front of the ark of the covenant and hang the curtain at the entrance of the tabernacle. Put the altar for blah, 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 blah. So it goes on. Moses did just as the Lord had commanded him. Thus Moses finished all the work. Then the cloud covered the tent of the meeting. The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of the meeting because the cloud settled upon it. And the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Whenever the cloud rose from the tabernacle, the Israelites would set out on their journey. But if the cloud did not lift, they would not go forward. Only when it lifted did they go forward. The cloud of the Lord was over the tabernacle by day, and fire in the cloud at night, in the sight of the whole house of Israel in all the stages of the journey. So you see how God, in leading the people through the promised land and so forth, how did he dwell with them in the form of a cloud? And so what happens then in the mind of Peter, James, and John, three Jews, when this cloud descends and a voice comes down from it, it's God himself descending and saying, this is my beloved son. In other words, That's the revelation that makes Jesus' identity known to Peter, James, and John. And then, you know, it says, and pretty much I think in all the three Gospels, it says they hid their eyes, just like Moses couldn't see the face of God, right? They hid their face. They were just like Elijah had to hide his face in the cloak, right? Peter, James, and John, they fell down in fear. They hid their face. When they looked up, they saw Jesus alone. So, the focus of the theophany of the cloud. And we see the Jesus say to them, again, what we've been talking about all along here, even in the first chapter of Matthew, which until today is all we've been in, this thing of the messianic secret. What's the messianic secret again, somebody who has been here? The messianic secret is what?
Well, who Christ really is.
And what does that mean? What does that term mean, the messianic secret? When Jesus says that?
The Messiah's secret. That would be that Christ was...
Don't tell anybody.
Don't tell anybody.
Because
don't reveal my identity until Jesus wants to.
Exactly. So, he clearly, his identity has been revealed at this thing, right? And there's shouldn't be any doubt as to what happened to Jesus. But what does he say coming down? Don't reveal the identity. And he even gives them a little more detail. The Gospel's down there somewhere, right? He says, until the Son of Man has risen from the dead. So again, he's giving us, you know, it's at his passion when he's in front of the high priest Caiaphas that Jesus himself reveals his identity. It's going to be his passion, death, and resurrection that reveals his identity, not anything else. So he tells them, don't tell anybody. But it shows that they still didn't get it because they wondered what raising from the dead would have meant. Again, you see, Jesus and Peter, James, and John would have been Pharisees. In other words, they would have believed in the resurrection of the dead. They had this experience, which they thought was the end of the world. They thought that this is it. Clearly the Messianic age had arrived. Jesus is that Messiah. The present world comes to an end now, and the life of the world to come now has been ushered in. It begins. We've witnessed its beginning, but now we're going down the mountain. Now, you know, wait a minute. You know, it seems to be back to normal again. What? This doesn't make any sense. Jews understood that messianic age is being inaugurated by an event like this. And the event like this came and it went, and now they're coming down the mountain. They're expressing their confusion. They don't know what happened. And you know, Jesus says, don't tell anybody until the time is right, right? And I'll let you know when the time, I'll tell them when the time is right. And they're clearly indicating that they don't get it and that they don't know what he's talking about when he says he has to die and rise again. Jesus also refers to himself, you'll notice in the Gospel, as the Son of Man, which is also a divine title. One day I want to spend some time looking at that, because that's, mm-hmm. for most people, that's a very confusing mm-hmm. thing. The Son of God is the human title. The Son of Man is the divine title. That comes from the book of Daniel. If you look at the Old Testament, kings would call themselves sons of God. You know, as a king of Israel, I am the Son of God. And they were recognized as sons of God. Son of God is the human title. When Jesus says, refers to himself as the Son of Man, he's referring to himself in the divine title that comes from the revelation given to Daniel, you know, to the prophet Daniel with the three, what's their names again? Abednego and Ashak, and what are the names of the three? Meshach, those people. You know, yeah.
If I ask this, and then you can answer some other time.
All right.
If the majority of people didn't see the actual, that Jesus came back, I mean, a few people saw it, and then it's word of mouth. So how could the whole nation be expected to believe this thing that they might not have even heard of Jesus to begin with. I don't know how far the word reached at that time. So if the Jews were waiting to see this thing, that the end of the world would be coming, and that none of this stuff ever happened before their eyes, what were they supposed to believe in?
Well, you know, we'll look at that more when we get into the resurrection narratives in Mark.
I believe it because I just believe it.
But how did they believe it?
Remember if Jesus said, remember at the Lazarus was in the bosom of Abraham, and his brother was in the torments of hell, and he begged God to let me go back and warn my brothers. And Jesus said, even if someone comes back from the dead, they won't believe. You know, there are plenty of indications that the world... Blessed are you, Thomas, you have believed because you have seen. Blessed are those who have not seen and believed.
But the word still would have had to reach them. Let's just pretend it's like Gainesville. There's no phones, there's no nothing.
No people either.
It happens right here. And we see it because we're right here, but how do they know about it over there?
Because go make disciples of all nations, baptizing them, and go tell them what happened.
But if the end of the world didn't happen, and that was their expectation, how would they, in their own minds as a Jew, have that confirmed to them?
They were at this point, they're still confused. It was after the coming of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost that this thing gets kind of...
I guess I'm trying to make an excuse for
it's a very good question, you know. And the easy answer is that they didn't know, they didn't get it, you know. They were on the road to Emmaus, right? The crucifixion happened and they said, oh, well, I guess we go home. It didn't work out the way we thought. And their Emmaus was away from Jerusalem. In other words, they were saying, okay, we wasted our time here. The disciples were, the very next day, they were back in their boats fishing. In other words, oh, well, I guess go back to what we did before. So, you know, they didn't get it. You know, they thought it was until that event, that central event called Pentecost, the coming of the Holy Spirit, you know, 40 days after Easter, and then their minds were open and so forth. So we'll go into that more when we get to that. But does that make sense a little bit? No.
I don't know. I just feel blessed that I believe it.
Are you wondering, what happens to people who didn't hear the message at that time?
Right.
And through no fault of their own, they didn't hear the message.
Exactly.
Because it didn't spread
quickly. Exactly.
Enough.
I think that's what...
And
I don't want to interrupt you. Talk about
that. That's St. Paul. Is it that's Romans. Why is God waiting for Jesus to... Why is Jesus waiting for this second coming? What is the reason that we've gone 2,000 years and Jesus has not come yet? According to St. Paul, it's because not everyone has heard the gospel.
Okay, but my parents heard... I mean, not that they heard it, but they know. And yet, they didn't believe because they're still waiting for a Messiah to come.
They heard with their ears in the sense they didn't hear with their heart.
They heard what Jesus taught them.
That's right. And so St. Paul is saying the second coming of Jesus will be marked by a mass conversion of the Jews. The Jews will finally hear the message of the gospel and convert.
That was the main thing I kept saying to my parents. You're waiting for the first time for him to come, and I'm waiting for the second time. I believe it. You don't. Mm-hmm. I don't get what happened.
You know, how all that is going to play out and so forth, you know, but... That's by according to Scripture, according to Saint Paul.
I guess it's always going to bother me.
Is what?
I said. I guess it's always going to bother me.
Well, God is at this. God in His patience, right? He's giving us all the time we need to accept His Son. Remember, Catholic teaching is there's only one way to the Father. Only one way to the Father, and that's through Jesus Christ. There's no other way by which man can be saved. That is a firm foundational belief of the Catholic faith. So now the next question is, what if somebody, what if they're a Jew, what if they're a Muslim, what if they're a Hindu? You know, we place our hope and trust in the mercy of God that somehow something will happen somewhere, maybe at that glimmer, that instant, you know, that for us could be a nanosecond, that for God could be 1,000 years, that at that moment of death, something, some kind of conversion, we don't know. But we hope that something like that happens. But there's no way to the Father except through Jesus. There's only one way to the Father. You hear Catholics all over the place today say, I believe there are many ways to God. I had a very close family member. You heard me too. And I kept my mouth shut because I was getting into enough arguments with them that night. But they said, I believe that there's many ways to God or to heaven. I forgot what she said. But I said, you know, you've given up on your Catholic faith because we say there is one way to the Father, and that is through Jesus and no other way.
But at the same time, like, we would never individually say, well, this person is going to hell.
That's right. We don't have that authority.
We don't know that.
We don't have that authority. That's we hope and we God. Trust in the mercy of God. I know a lot of people don't like that answer, but what else have we got?
The last judgment, like Jesus will say, do you believe or you don't?
Well, that's at the end, the absolute end. You're going to see him come back in glory. Those who say even then that, no, sorry, guy, you know, okay, you know, you've made your decision, but. And the Catholic Church still teaches that there's no salvation outside the church.
We don't hear that.
You don't hear that. No, because that's not politically correct. But the church, you know, that still always has and still teaches that there is no salvation outside the church. Again, and we try, you know, we say, if you know that the fullness of the truth subsists in the Catholic faith and still choose to leave it, you've given up your salvation. And in the Second Vatican Council, they purposely use that word subsists. In the fullness of the faith subsists in the Catholic Church, because nobody was quite sure what subsists means, you know. Seriously, I mean, that's what all the things that went on. Because there, I know, you know, we all know Baptists, evangelicals, that are more Catholic than a lot of Catholics. Yeah? That live the gospel more faithfully than many, many Catholics do. So what is the next question is, what does Catholic mean when you say there is no salvation outside the church?
The nurse came to us from him, what was going on, and she's Baptist, and something came up, and she just said, there's one God. And that was, we left it at that. She just said, one God. I'm not going to argue. That wasn't the scenario to argue. But I'm just saying, that was brought up as we were praying.
And I don't even know if it's me being politically correct and falling into that trap or whatever, but, you know, I guess what I like to think is that that umbrella that we call the Catholic Church is a lot bigger than most Catholics realize. But what do I know in that sense? All I know is I see, you know, evangelical Protestants living the gospel more faithfully than a lot of Catholics. And so what am I to make of that? You know, what is any of us to make of that? But still, there's only one way to the Father, and that is through Jesus. There is no other way. They believe in Jesus. But there is no other way. So Muslims, Jews, you know, well, they would believe they're going to hell. We know some evangelicals who, if you haven't claimed Jesus as your Lord and Savior, you're going to hell. So Jews and Muslims and Hindus and atheists and they're all going to hell. You know, we would say we don't. Only God has the authority to send someone to hell. We can't judge people. That's what it means. Who am I to judge? You can't judge that. You know, you could judge somebody's actions, but you can't judge their heart. Only God can do that. We have no authority. It's above our pay grade to decide someone else's salvation or not. So anyway, better. So we will come back to the Son one day as the Son of Man, because that's a very, very, and once you understand that, if you go back and reread Jesus' words where he refers to himself as the Son of Man, it's again one of those goosebump kind of experiences when you really fully understand what he's saying in the context of the book of Daniel, which was probably the most messianic prophecy of, you know, more so than Isaiah or Ezekiel or any of those people. You know, Daniel was extremely messianic oriented. Okay. So anything else? Let's move on to the Old Testament reading. Because it's a hard Old Testament reading. But an important one. Remember the... I'm going to volunteer to read
somebody
here.
Somebody want to read Diane?
Remember, the purpose during Lent of the Old Testament readings is to give salvation history. Outside
I'm
of...
I'm going to read all of this. Oh, my gosh. Okay.
That's the first reading.
Okay. God put Abraham to the test. He called to him, Abraham. Here I am, he replied. Then God said, take your son Isaac, your only one whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah. There you shall offer him up as a holocaust on a height that I will point out to you. And they came to the place at which God had told them. Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. Then he reached out and took the knife to slaughter his son. But the Lord's messenger called to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. Here I am, he answered. Do not lay your hand on the boy, said the messenger. Do not do the least thing to him. I now know how devoted you are to God, since you did not withhold from me your own beloved son. As Abraham looked about, he spied a ram caught by his horns in the thicket. So he went and took the ram and offered it up as a holocaust in place of his son. Again the Lord's messenger called for Abraham from heaven and said, I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you acted as you did in not withholding from me your beloved son, I will bless you abundantly and make your descendants as countless as the stars of the sky and the sands of the seashore. Your descendants shall take possession of the gates of their enemies, and in your descendants all the nations of the earth shall find blessing. All this because you obeyed my command.
Okay. Is that a hard reading or is that a hard reading? What do you think?
That's the toughest thing. I can't imagine. I just can't imagine taking someone you love, part of you.
You know the story, right, in full. Abraham and Sarah, they were all up in age. They didn't have a son. Abraham wanted a son, so he had a son, Hagar. Hagar is the maid. Ishmael, right, through his maid Hagar. Right, but that's not... But God promised them that they would have their... He and Sarah would have their own son, right? What does the word, he changed his name from Abram to Abraham. Abraham means father of many nations, father of a multitude. Right? Sarah means God makes me laugh, because in her old age, God told her you're going to have a child. And they waited 25 years, and in her old age, even though she was barren, Sarah had their Abraham's son named Isaac. Okay, so they waited 25 years. That long promised son that God promised Isaac, and now God is asking Abraham to sacrifice that son, to offer him as a sacrifice. Yeah. You know, what is this father of many nations, and is be through Isaac that this Abraham's let you know. Fatherhood would extend to, in a certain sense, this day. And now God is asking him to kill him, to human sacrifice him, to put Abraham to a test.
Can I get your pen? I just want to get rid of this. Sorry.
That's okay. To put Abraham to a test. You know, that one heck of a test, don't you think?
But it came from God.
But it came
from God. That made it much easier. Because usually we never know if we're doing the right thing or not.
Thank you.
And if God says do it, then chances are that's the right thing.
Yeah. It should be noted that nowhere else in the entire Old Testament does God ask for a human sacrifice. This is the only place where that happens. And Jews, as a matter of fact, considered... This nuts, the Gehenna idea, right? Jews consider this idea of human sacrifice so appalling, so anathema. I mean, there's something they can't, a Jew would never do, is offer another human in sacrifice. And yet, God asks Abraham to make a human sacrifice of his own son.
So is this where you say, don't ask what it is, just what it means?
I think it's even in some ways tougher than that. You know, there are tests and there are tests. The first question you would ask, isn't there some other way that God could have tested Abraham's faith, you know, to ask him to go to the point of killing his own son?
Was Abraham positive that this was God? Or did they not have doubts in those days?
Well, you know, there's a couple of ways to answer that question. With the way, if we read the text literally, Abraham is obeying as though he believes it's God, you know.
I mean, he didn't get to discernment of the spirit yet, because that guy didn't come along yet. So I always wondered where these guys...
You know, I think the only...
Faith was on anyone.
You know, the only... We're fortunate as Christians in that the only way to answer this question about this unique incident in the Old Testament about God asking someone to commit human sacrifice is in light of the New Testament. Because, okay, we know the story. God stops Abraham from killing his son. He sends the angel and says, okay, you passed your test. Don't actually kill the boy. So the boy is not actually killed. But God didn't spare himself the sacrifice of his own son when the time came. And in terms of what you bring up, you know, not... Well, you know, this. What does this mean? If you look at your sheets, as Christians, we could always say, you know, God here is pointing to something he himself will do 2,000 years in the future with the sacrifice of his own son. He won't intervene and stop the sacrifice of Jesus, but the sacrifice will happen for the sake of the salvation of the world. And so in terms of your question, you know, well, what does it mean? I put several parallels there. Look at the first, there are two columns, right? The first parallel, Father Abraham offers his only beloved son as a sacrifice. This column on the right, the Heavenly Father offers his only beloved son, Christ. Second parallel, the only beloved son, Isaac in this case, if you remember the reading, carries the wood of his own sacrifice up the mountain and then is laid down on the wood to become the sacrifice.
Did he know he was the sacrifice while he carried the wood?
No.
Okay, but no. Jesus knew when he carried the cross.
You can look at the question that Isaac asked. He said, "Who? I see the wood, I see the fire, I see the this, I see the that, but where is the lamb? Where is the sacrifice?" So what does Abraham say? Don't worry, God himself will provide. That's an insightful line right there. Don't worry, God himself will provide the sacrifice. Abraham didn't say to Isaac, you are the sacrifice. He said, don't worry, God himself will provide. Just trust. In other words, trust in God. What did Jesus do? He trusted in God. That was what the whole point of the salvation of Jesus is. Total trust in his God the Father. Right? Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. So on the right, Jesus carries the wood of his own sacrifice up the mountain to Golgotha in order to be laid on the wood as a sacrifice for the sins of the world. There's a third parallel. What does God say to Abraham? Because you have done this, all the nations of the world are going to be blessed through you because of what you were willing to do. When does this actually take place? When Christ ascends, you know, again, those words, because you have done this, all the nations of the world are going to be blessed through you. When does this blessing actually happen in that third parallel? When Christ ascends the wood of the cross and dies on the cross. One of the first things that's going to happen is the conversion of the Gentile centurion, who is going to say, surely this man was the Son of God. And he's going to be the kind of first fruits, this Gentile, of the rest of the whole world coming to recognize Jesus as the Messiah and the Son of God. As a fourth parallel, when Isaac is saved from being sacrificed, God provides the substitute of a ram caught in a thicket, a thorn bush, by his horns. Many of the ancient church fathers, we'll look at it, we could spend 2 weeks just looking at what the church fathers have to say about this incident. Many of the ancient church fathers saw that as a type of Christ too, because they saw Christ as the Lamb. The ram was a symbol for kings and kingship like David. So Christ is like that, the royal king who wears a crown made out of thorns. And he's going to be the substitute. He is going to take Isaac's place, in a sense, so that he will lay down his life in sacrifice so that the world might be blessed. You seeing the parallels between this was being called for in the sacrifice of Isaac? You see why Abraham is called our father in faith. Right? Fifth parallel. In chapter 22 of Genesis, we read chapter 22. Does it say, Moriah, right? It makes it clear that the place where Isaac is sacrificed is Mount Moriah. Well, later on in the Bible, in 2 Chronicles, we have one other reference to Mount Moriah in the Old Testament. And it says that's where King Solomon built the temple in Jerusalem, on Mount Moriah. In other words, Abraham offers his beloved son, Isaac, on the same mountain in Jerusalem, that Jesus, the beloved son of the Father, is going to lay down his life for the sins of the world. It's the same place. It's the same mountain. So that brings us to another point. Remember I suggested that whenever you read the Old Testament, you should always have a dictionary with you. Did I mark the page yet? About what do words mean? Right? So in this case, Moriah. I said, what does Moriah? I actually didn't necessarily know this myself, but I said, let me take my own advice. Let me get out one of the dictionaries and let me look up the Hebrew word Moriah. And Moriah means chosen of the Lord.
What about Golgotha?
It's a mountain in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a city on a hill.
But that's where he was crucified, so is that the same thing as Moriah?
It's the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is up on a hill. Right? So think that the Moriah means the chosen of the Lord. So where did God ask Abraham to sacrifice Isaac? On the mountain of the chosen of the Lord. Where does Jesus actually get sacrificed? On the mountain of the chosen of the Lord. The parallels are absolutely amazing. And the other aspect of that, the Jews at the time of Jesus certainly would have understood all this. The crucifixion hasn't taken place yet, so that they wouldn't have seen. But ancient Jews would have understood that Abraham offered Isaac in Jerusalem, and now after this Pentecost experience, imagine the light bulbs going off. God asked Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac on the mountain of the chosen one, Mount Moriah in Jerusalem, which is also the mountain on which the city of Jerusalem is built. And where does Jesus get sacrificed? The actual son of the Father, on that very same mountain. You know, unless you really study the Old Testament in this way and even look at what, you miss all this. That's why I think all what we do here, my humble opinion, that what we do here is so important. In other words, God has got this planned out from all eternity, from day one. He knew exactly, of course, God knew exactly what was going to happen. And he's giving his people the signs to see what he's doing as salvation. That's their salvation history, how salvation history is played out right before our eyes.
Yeah, I could study the Bible for 1,000 years and I wouldn't put this together.
Well, if you have enough references, enough books to study, I don't make this stuff. I mean, I go to books.
You weren't born with this.
I was not born with this. No, I study this stuff, and I
That was my conspiracy theory in grade school. Everyone else was born with the knowledge.
We're running low on time, and I want to make sure I get to a couple of other things that... The one question, and it really isn't a complete answer to this, but why did Jesus choose Peter, James, and John? This is now a little bit on the church fathers, very briefly on the church fathers. Why did Jesus choose Peter, James, and John to bring up to this mountain of the Transfiguration? Peter, James, and John, you'll recall, are the ones he brought with him into the Garden of Gethsemane, and they saw him. They fell asleep. But they saw him sweating, greatly. They're going to be the firsthand witnesses of his suffering and death. Okay, so there's a church father known as Ephrem the Syrian. It's on your sheet, right? He's also known as Ephrem the Deacon. He lived in the 4th century, not long after the Council of Nicaea. And he answers this question as to why Peter, James, and John. Jesus took the apostles up the mountain for 3 reasons. First, to show them the glory of his divinity. Then to declare himself Israel's redeemer. And thirdly, to prevent the apostles from being scandalized at seeing him soon afterward enduring those human sufferings which he had freely accepted for our sake. He took them up onto the mountain in order to show them his kingship before they witnessed his passion, to let them see his mighty power before they watched his death, to reveal his glory to them before they beheld his humiliation. So, you know, maybe you could say that Jesus knew that if without the Transfiguration, without them witnessing, seeing Jesus as he truly existed, they would never have been able to withstand what they saw with his passion and death. They would have been so scandalized that maybe they would have left. Maybe they would have said, we don't believe this. We don't. So he was preparing them. He was preparing them for what they were going to see. In other words, I have power over this. I am freely choosing to do this. I am freely choosing to lay down my life if that's what it takes. For what God said in Abraham, sacrificing Isaac for the salvation of the world. So prepare yourselves. This is not going to be an easy thing to witness. You see?
Is it also because he knew they were going to write the Gospels?
Well, they didn't write the Gospels per se, right? The Gospels came. They preached what became the Gospels, right? Peter through Mark,
so they had to see
James.
They had to see it firsthand, though.
Yeah.
So.
Well, they were going to see it firsthand one way or the other, but they didn't. He didn't want them to be scandalized by what they saw. You know, I mean, your leader, your one you put all your hopes in now, so humiliatingly executed. You know, maybe he's not who he says he is.
But they did, right? And Peter denied him.
Oh yeah, that's right. They were scared. They still, you know,
they were human. Yeah, but I was just thinking that Abraham had that faith complete, and they didn't.
Yeah, but until he waited 25 years for that son, so he knew God had some intervention there. You know.
Yeah, but they saw the Transfiguration and still denied it. Yeah, I don't know. It seems.
Well, you know, in terms of church fathers, there is so much, and you can go. For major events like this, you can go to book after book after book. And so what I did is the one I showed you, the one for Mark, that we've been using on the Church Fathers, it goes on and on and on about the Transfiguration in chapter 9. But what I did is at the beginning of it, it has, I took the copy, what you see there is the overview, right? And the overview kind of gives you a synopsis of what all the church fathers said. You've got one?
Oh, this. Yeah. separating it for you. I'm
I was
trying.
Looking up the book again.
No.
Is that the book we were all going to buy?
No, 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 no. This is not.
Is this just one page?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one page. And, you know, maybe in the interest of time, it is 11 o'clock, I'll let you read the overview, because the overview simply gives a synopsis of what all the church fathers, or a lot of the church fathers, said on this issue. So maybe I won't read that. The thing I will do, though, which I think is interesting for us, is, you know, we said this whole business about God asking someone to do a human sacrifice, it was unique in all of the Old Testament. Never anywhere else did God ever ask anyone to sacrifice a human being. And how could God ask that? And my answer was, we could only make sense of this in light of the New Testament. So this I thought to myself of, well, what about the Jews? What do they think? They don't have the New Testament, right? What do they have to say about this atrocious request? I mean, let's be honest. This atrocious request on the part of God to ask Abraham to kill his own son. And so I went to two Jewish commentaries. This is the one I had. I showed you this before.
Yeah,
right?
I know. I just couldn't find it.
It's like a 27 volumes. You know, it's a set, and this is just one part of Mark. So
maybe why I burned it.
Yeah. This is more. I'm sorry the way these copies came out. It did not come out well. But pass those around. That's from a kind of an Orthodox Jewish commentary. I want to draw your attention to a couple of lines in there. And yeah, pass that one around too. That's from a more modern Jewish commentary. Again, I didn't want to crack the binding of the book, so I didn't want to press too hard to make this copy. But, I mean, they say some interesting things. And since I just made one page for you, I'll just read that one page. This goes on for quite a few pages, but the text is just from the Bible, right? And because it's a Jewish commentary, the text is in Hebrew, and then on the left it's in English. But you see on the bottom footnote there.
I was looking to see if I could still remember what page. I used to read all
Diane.
Yeah. On page 109, the thing where it says, offer him. Let me read it to you, so I don't think you could read what I have there. It's very tight in the original book here. You see, that's the problem. The text is literally, and take him up. Okay, so this is a Jewish commentary on this now. They say the text literally says in Hebrew, and take him up. God did not tell him to sacrifice Isaac. God did not, but only to take him up in order to offer him as a burnt offering, because it was not his intention to have him sacrificed. Then talking about other references that he refers to, if you have the book. E remarks that the purpose of the interpretation is to answer the difficulty, how could God command, countermand his own order? It is, however, unnecessary, since the opening statement of the chapter makes it clear that it was only a trial. Hence, the literal and usual meaning of offer him is to remain. So you see how they're, I don't want to say spinning it, because that makes it sound bad. But, you know, they're kind of taking, a Jewish commentary is taking that God never really asked him to kill Isaac. He said to be willing to offer him, you know, so that they're kind of saying it was God's intention all along. Is it here? Let me see. When did I read it? Oh, and then 5, always on the last thing, abide ye here.
Where is it?
Bottom of page 109, comment 5 in the commentary. In terms of the meaning of abide ye here, that they should not attempt to stop him from carrying out the sacrifice, we will come back. So, remember, again, what they're saying is, if you read that, again, I didn't want to make a copy of the whole book. But what the Jewish commentary here is saying, that, remember, it was Abraham, Isaac, and a servant began on the journey. Right? And when they came to Mount Moriah, Abraham said to the servant, remain here until we come back. Which means that Abraham knew he was not going to have to sacrifice Isaac. Because he said to the servant, wait here until we return. You see? Interesting. You know how they're... You see how you have to really get into the phrases of each thing that's said here.
But that's still just that guy's interpretation, right?
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes, it is a scholarly commentary on all this. But that's all we've got, you know? We've got what the text says, and we've got what the scholars think it means. From a Christian perspective or from a Jewish perspective. I also gave you a more modern commentary. That's a single sheet here. This is the kind of book that maybe you would be studying if you were in a Hebrew school, you know, that sort of thing, in a synagogue. You know, if you were doing the same thing we're doing here, if you were doing it in a synagogue, if you want to see this book, I know you like to...
just to see what we were talking about.
Yeah, and this is from a copy of the Torah, the 5 books of Moses, from a commentary on the 5 books of Moses.
The scrolls.
Yeah, but that I'm not going to bring a scroll. I don't have a scroll.
Of course not. But that's what
carrying
walk
on my shoulder.
Yeah, that's what they walk around the synagogue with.
That's right. Like most of us have Bibles, but we process it with this big book of the Gospels. Right, it's kind of that idea. The overview. I copied the overview from that book. No, what did I copy? I lost it.
The sacrifice.
Look how they explain it. The practice of human sacrifice, which was well known to the ancients and central to the cults of Israel's neighbor, stands as a backdrop to chapter 22. In the framework of his time and experience, Abraham could have considered the command to sacrifice his son entirely legitimate. Otherwise, he might have protested God's command with the kind of insistence he exhibited at Sodom and Gomorrah. God's demand must have struck Abraham as harsh and bitter, but not as ungodly. It is therefore important to notice that in the beginning of the test, the command is issued by Elohim. If you read, again, if you look at the Torah, the 5 books, the way they're all supposedly written by Moses, but they're clearly not all written by Moses, because the writing style in Hebrew is very, very different. Even the way they address God is different. Elohim is how you would just talk about God, gods, even lowercase g, gods. Adonai would be Lord, the God, right? And the the word you can't say, Yahweh, the Tetragrammaton, is yet a third way that God is referred to in the Torah. So they're saying, okay, look at how the titles for God are being used, and you can get something out of that. They're saying, it is therefore important to notice that in the beginning of the test, the command is issued by Elohim, the generic term for God, or even gods with a lowercase g. And the command is one that other Elohim could and did make. In other words, the pagan religions. Their gods have human sacrifice all the time. No big deal. But when the sacrifice is about to be performed, it is Abraham's God, Adonai, who stays his hand. Elohim might ask him to proceed, but Adonai says no. He too will ask extreme devotion, but it will never take this form again. You see how interesting that is? They're looking at the different, in the Hebrew, what we would translate as the word God or Lord or whatever, in the original language, they use different words for God and Lord. And the command to execute the son, sacrifice the son, is by an Elohim, which could be a lowercase God. But the God who says, stop, don't do this, is Adonai, the Lord of the God. You see? How studying the text is so important.
Well, can sometime you go into that thing about Elohim being like plural gods and then...
That's the end. There's a lot we could...
So much
we could go into here. And then that last paragraph, that's where they stick it to us, okay? This is a Jewish commentary now, right? Abraham's religion not only rejects the sacrifice of a son by a father, but rejects as well its use as a theological theme. This is in stark contrast to Eastern religions and to Christianity, in which a father's sacrificial gift of his son plays an important role. We're talking about the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross, which to them was not. Anyway, that's it's after 11. We better stop. It's 11:08. But you see the depth here. You see the depth. You see the importance of looking at even the original languages when reading this. Because it could all be washed out so easily otherwise.
Is there class next week?
Yes. Yes. Yes, there is. All right, if you want to pass those two books down, I better start to pack up and go.
He wants them back.
Bob, do you know if Robert will be at Mass today?
I think he's working today.
He's working. Do you know if
there's some kind of a competition going on?
I'll tell you what, tomorrow night, and he's aware of it, but I just want to make sure. I don't have a way to contact him. Diane? I just want to make sure that he remembers that we're meeting at 7 in the church.
Here, this is for Diane too.
She's in Colorado.
She's in Colorado? Yeah. Oh, wow. And he said Monday was a good night. So, but he, you know,
usually they both have that one on.
Yeah, so
here we go.
She's a member.
Is this yours, Carol? Or is this actually?
I don't know if I have a number or not. I do.
Okay.
Yeah, she had texted it to me, so.
I'll tell them also, but just so that you'll have the contact.
She'd love to get contact. She's getting used to the new church.
6, 3, 5, 6. Yeah, great. Okay, thank you.
She's living with her sister.
Her sister and her brother.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So long.